Chapter 16. At first, no one paid any attention to the tiny blur that crept across the outer edge of the side-scan sonar's recording paper. 6 hours into the search, they had found several man-made objects. Parts of the downed aircraft that were pinpointed for retrieval, a sunken fishing trawler, bits and pieces of junk thrown over by fishing fleets seeking shelter in the fjord from storms, all were identified by video camera and eliminated. The last anomaly was not resting on the bottom of the fjord as expected. It sat inside a small inlet encircled by sheer cliffs. Only one end protruded into clear water. The rest was buried under a wall of ice. Pitt was the first to realize its significance. He was sitting in front of the recorder, surrounded by Giordino, Commander Knight, and the archaeologists. He spoke into a transmitter. "Swing the fish, bearing 150 degrees." The Polar Explorer was still stationary in the icebound fjord. Outside, on the pack, a team led by Cork Simon had augured through the ice and lowered the sensing unit into the water. Very slowly, they swung the fish, as they called it, scanning a 360-degree grid. After searching one area, they unreeled more cable and tried again at another site farther away from the ship. Simon acknowledged Pitt's command and twisted the cable until the fish's sonar probes were trained at 150 degrees. "How's this?" he queried. "You're right on target," Pitt replied from the ship. Seen from a better angle, the target became more distinct. Pitt circled it with a black felt pen. "I think we've got something." Granquist moved in closer and nodded. "Not much showing to identify. What do you make of it?" "Pretty vague," answered Pitt. "You have to use some imagination, since most of the object is covered by ice that has fallen from the surrounding cliffs. But the part that shows underwater suggests a wooden ship. There's a definite angular shape coming together at what might be a high curving sternpost."
"Yes," said Lily excitedly, "high and graceful, typical of a 4th-century merchant ship."
"Don't get carried away," cautioned Knight. "She could be an old sail-rigged fisherman."
"Possibly." Giordino looked thoughtful. "But if my memory serves me correctly, the Danes, Icelanders, and Norwegians who have fished these waters over the centuries sailed in more narrow-beamed double-enders."
"You're right," said Pitt. "The sharp bow and stern were handed down from the Vikings. What we're seeing here might also be a double-ender, but with a broader sweep."
"Can't get a clear picture through the ice-covered section of the hull," said Granquist. "But we could drop a camera back of the stern in clear water for a better identification."
Giordino looked doubtful. "A camera might confirm the stern section of a wrecked ship, but little else."
"We've plenty of strong male backs on the ship," said Lily. "We could tunnel down through the ice and inspect it first hand."
Granquist took a pair of binoculars and walked out of the electronics compartment to the bridge. He returned in half a minute.
"I make the ice cover over the wreck to be a good 3 meters thick. Take at least 2 days to cut through."
"You'll have to dig without us, I'm afraid," said Knight. "My orders are to get underway before 1800 hours. We've no time left for a lengthy excavation."
Granquist was taken aback.
"That's only 5 hours from now."
Knight made a helpless gesture.
"I'm sorry, I have no say in the matter."
Pitt studied the dark spot on the recording paper. Then he turned to Knight. "If I proved positively that's a 4th-century Roman ship out there, could you persuade North Atlantic Command to keep us on station for another day or two?"
Knight's eyes took on a foxy look.
"What are you cooking up?"
"Will you go along?" Pitt crowded him.
"Yes," Knight stated firmly. "But only if you prove, without a shadow of a doubt, that's a 1,000-year-old shipwreck."
"Then it's a deal."
"How are you going to do it?"
"Simple," said Pitt, reeling Knight in.
"I'm going to dive under the ice and come up into the hull."
Cork Simon and his crew worked quickly at cutting an access hole through the 1-meter-thick ice sheet with chainsaws. They quarried multiple squares until they reached the final layer. They broke through with a sledgehammer mounted on a long pipe and then removed the ice fragments with grappling hooks so Pitt could safely submerge. When he was satisfied the hole was clear, Simon walked a few steps and entered a small canvas-covered shelter. The interior was heated and warm and crowded with men and diving equipment. An air compressor sat next to the heating unit, chugging away. Its exhaust vented to the outside. Lily and the other archaeologists were sitting at a folding table in one corner of the shelter, making a series of drawings and discussing them with Pitt as he suited up for the dive.
"Ready when you are," Simon announced.
"Another 5 minutes," Giardino replied, while busily checking the valve assemblies and regulator on a Mark I Navy diver's mask. Pitt had slipped a special dry suit over long underwear made of heavy nylon pile for thermal insulation. Next, he pulled on a hood and then a quick-release weight belt while trying to absorb a cram course in ancient ship construction.
In early merchant vessels, the shipwrights favored cedar and cypress, and often pine for the planking, lectured Grandquist. They mostly used oak for the keel.
"I won't be able to tell one wood from another," Pitt said.
"Then study the hull. The planks were tightly joined by tenons and mortises. Many ships had lead plates laid on their underwater surface. The hardware may be of iron or copper."
"But what about the rudder?" asked Pitt.
"Anything I should look for in design and fastenings?"
"You won't find a stern-centered rudder," said Sam Hoskins. "They didn't turn up for another 800 years. All early Mediterranean merchantmen used twin steering oars that extended from the aft quarters."
"Do you want a reserve come-home air bottle?" Giardino interrupted.
Pitt shook his head.
"Not necessary for a dive this shallow as long as I'm on a lifeline."
Giardino lifted the Mark I mask and helped Pitt pull it down over his head. He checked the face seal, adjusted the position, and cinched up the spider straps. The air supply was on, and when Pitt signaled that he had proper airflow, Giardino secured the communications line to the mask. While one of the Navy men unreeled and straightened the air supply hose and communications line, Giardino tied a manila lifeline around Pitt's waist. He performed the pre-dive checkout and then donned a headset with microphone.
"You hear me okay?" he asked.
"Clear but faint," Pitt answered. "Turn up the volume a notch."
"Better?"
"Much."
"How do you feel?"
"Nice and cozy so long as I'm breathing warm air."
"All set?"
Pitt answered by making an okay sign with his thumb and forefinger. He paused to hook an underwater dive light to his belt. Lily gave him a hug and gazed up through his face mask.
"Good hunting, and be careful."
He winked back at her.
He turned and walked through the entryway of the shelter into the cold outside, trailed by two Navy men who tended his lines. Giardino began to follow when Lily clutched his arm.
"Will we be able to hear him?" she asked anxiously.
"Yes, I've connected him to a speaker. You and Dr. Grandquist can stay here where it's warm and listen in. If you have a message for Pitt, simply come and tell me and I'll pass it on."
Pitt walked stiffly to the edge of the ice hole and sat down. The air temperature had dropped to zero. It was a crystalline November day with a biting edge, courtesy of a 10-mile-an-hour wind. As he slipped on his fins, he looked up at the sheer sides of the mountains that soared above the inlet. The tons of snow and ice clinging to the steep palisades seemed as if they could fall at any moment. He turned to the upper end of the fjord, where he could see glacier arms curling and grinding toward the sea. Then he looked down. The water in the dive hole looked jade, ominous, and cold. Commander Knight approached and put his hand on Pitt's shoulder. All he could see was a pair of intense green eyes through the glass of the mask. He spoke loudly so Pitt could hear.
1 hour, 23 minutes left. I thought you ought to know.
Pitt gave him a steel-edged stare, but did not reply. He made a thumbs-up sign and slipped through the narrow hole into the forbidding water. He slowly settled past the encircling white walls. He felt as if he were diving down a well. Once clear, he was dazzled by the glistening kaleidoscope of color from the sun's rays that penetrated the ice. The underside of the sheet was jagged and uneven and specked with small hanging stalactites formed by brine from the rapidly freezing fresh water carried into the fjord by glaciers. Underwater visibility was almost 80 meters on a horizontal range. He glanced down and saw a small kelp community grasping the rocky mass carpeting the bottom. Thousands of small shrimp-like crustaceans suspended in the still water swirled past his sight. A huge 3-meter bearded seal eyed him curiously at a distance, tufts of coarse bristles sprouting from its muzzle. Pitt waved his arms, and the big seal shot him a wary look and swam away. Pitt touched the bottom and paused to equalize his ears. There was a danger in diving with a buoyancy compensator-type life jacket under ice, and he did not wear one. He was slightly heavy, so he adjusted by removing and dropping a lead weight from his belt. The air that flowed from the compressor through a filter and then an accumulator into his mask tasted bland but pure.
He gazed upward and oriented himself from the eerie glow of the ice hole and checked his compass. He hadn't bothered to carry a depth gauge. He wouldn't be working in water over 4 meters deep.
"Talk to me," the voice of Al Giardino came through the mask's earphones. "I'm on the bottom," replied Pitt. "All systems up to par."
Pitt spun and stared through the green void. "She lies about 10 meters north of me. I'm going to move toward her. Give me some slack in the lines."
He swam slowly, taking care his lines didn't foul on the rock outcroppings. The intense cold of the frigid water began to seep into his body. He was thankful Giardino had had the foresight to see that his air supply was warm and dry. The stern of the wreck slowly unveiled before his eyes. The sides were covered with a mat of algae. He brushed away a small area with his gloved hand, stirring up a green cloud. He waited a minute for the cloud to dissipate and then peered at the result. "Inform Lily and Doc, I'm looking at a wooden hull without a stern rudder, but no sign of steering oars."
"Acknowledged," said Giardino.
Pitt pulled a knife from a sheath strapped to one leg and pried at the underside of the hull near the keel. The point revealed soft metal.
"We have a lead-sheathed bottom," he announced.
"Looking good," replied Giardino.
"Doc Grundquist wants to know if there's any sign of carving on the sternpost."
"Hold on."
Pitt carefully wiped off the growth over a flat section of the sternpost just before it disappeared upward into the ice, waiting patiently for the resulting algae cloud to drift away.
"There's some kind of a hardwood plaque embedded into the sternpost. I can make out lettering and a face."
"A face?"
"With a curly head of hair and heavy beard."
"What does it read?"
"Sorry, I can't translate Greek."
"Not Latin?" Giardino asked, skeptically.
The raised carving was indistinct in the shimmering light that filtered through the ice. Pitt moved in until his face mask nearly touched the wooden plaque.
"Greek," Pitt stated firmly.
"Certain?"
"I used to go with a girl who was an Alpha Delta Pi."
"Hold on, you've thrown the bone pickers into spasms."
After nearly 2 minutes, Giardino's voice returned over the earphones. "Grundquist thinks you're hallucinating, but Mike Graham says he studied classical Greek in college and asks if you can describe the lettering.
First letter resembles an S shaped like a lightning strike. Then an A with the right leg missing. Next, a P followed by another handicapped A and what looks like an inverted L or a gallows. Then an I. Last letter is another lightning strike S. That's the best I can do."
Listening over the speaker inside the shelter, Graham copied Pitt's meager description on the page of a notebook until he had sigma, alpha, rho, alpha, pi, iota, sigma. He scrutinized what appeared to be a word for several moments. Something was out of place. He struggled to jog his memory, and then he had it. The letters were classical but Eastern Greek. His thoughtful expression slowly turned incredulous. He furiously wrote a short word, tore out the page, and held it up. In modern capitals it read, "Serapis." Lily stared at Graham questioningly.
"Does it mean anything?"
Grundquist said, "I think it's the name of a Greek-Egyptian god."
"A popular deity throughout the Mediterranean," agreed Hoskins. "Modern spelling is usually S-E-R-A-P-I-S."
"So our ship is the Serapis," murmured Lily pensively.
Knight grunted.
"So we might have either a Roman, Grecian, or Egyptian shipwreck. Which is it?"
"We're over our heads," answered Grundquist. "We'll need the expertise of a marine archaeologist who knows ancient Mediterranean shipping to sort this one out."
Below the ice, Pitt moved across the starboard side of the hull, stopping where the planking vanished into the ice. He swam around the sternpost to the port. The planking looked warped and bowed outward. A few kicks of his fins, and he could see a section that was stove in by the ice. He eased up to the opening and slipped his head inside. It was like looking in a dark closet. He saw only vague, indiscernible shapes. He reached in and felt something round and hard. He gauged the distance between the broken planks. The gap was too small to squeeze his shoulders through. He grasped the upper plank, planted a finned foot against the hull, and pulled. The well-preserved wood slowly bent but refused to give. Pitt tried both feet and heaved with everything he had. The plank still held firm.
When he was just about to call it quits, the tree nail suddenly tore off the inside ribs and the waterlogged wood peeled away, throwing Pitt backward in awkward slow motion against a large rock. Any respectable, card-carrying marine archaeologist would have gone into cardiac arrest at such irreverent brutality toward an ancient artifact. Pitt felt totally unsympathetic toward academic scruples. He was cold and getting colder. His shoulder began to ache from the impact on the rock, and he knew he couldn't stay down much longer. "I found a break in the hull," he said, panting like a marathon runner. "Send down a camera." "Understood," replied the stolid voice of Giordino. "Come back and I'll pass it to you." Pitt returned to the dive hole and followed his bubbles to the surface. Giordino lay on his stomach on the ice, reached down and handed Pitt a compact underwater video camera recorder. "Take a few meters of tape and get out," said Giordino. "You've accomplished enough." "What about Commander Knight?" "Hold tight, I'll put him on." Knight's voice came over the earphones. "Dirk?" "Go ahead, Byron." "Are you 100% certain we've got a 1,000-year-old relic in pristine condition? All indications look solid." "I'll need something tangible if I'm to convince Atlantic Command to keep us on station another 48 hours. Stand by and I'll seal it with a kiss." "An identifiable antiquity will suffice," Knight said dourly. Pitt threw a wave and faded from view. He did not enter the wreck immediately. How long he floated motionless outside the jagged opening, he couldn't be sure. Probably about 1 minute, certainly no longer than two. Why he hesitated, he didn't know. Maybe he was waiting for an invitation from a skeletal hand beckoning from within. Maybe he was afraid of finding nothing more than debris from an 80-year-old Icelandic fishing schooner. Or maybe he was just leery of entering what might be a tomb. Finally, he lowered his head, tightened his shoulders, and cautiously kicked his fins. The black unknown opened up, and he swam in.